All right, good afternoon, everyone. You're tuned in 94.1 FM KPFA here in Berkeley and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. It is now 1 p.m. Please stay with us for Terra Verde.
Welcome to Terra Verde, a weekly environmental radio show on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. I'm your host, Adam Greenfield. In 2011, the Occupy movement made a big entrance into the activist world as a large-scale direct action movement intended to challenge authority and address massive inequality across society. The movement's focus has generally been on economic inequality, but what lessons could be exported from Occupy to address the current environmental emergency? Well, this is certainly an interesting question for my guest today, who co-authored a book released earlier in 2011 entitled Deep Green Resistance. The book calls for a radical change in tactics and strategies for stopping our civilization's environmental destruction, and instead advocates for a resistance movement that employs a full spectrum of strategies. Well, the authors of Deep Green Resistance, Lier Keith and Eric McBay, join me today to discuss what this new resistance movement might look like. Lier, welcome to Terra Verde.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on again.
And Eric, also welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Okay, so Lier, we're going to start with you. What's wrong with the current dominant discourse over addressing the destruction that humans are bringing upon the planet? For example, isn't it enough to change cars, buy local, and other personal lifestyle options?
Well, no. And part of the problem is that our capacity for resistance has really been reduced. You know, we're animals that need habitat, right? And we're not even allowed to think in those terms anymore. And we're not even allowed to think in terms of, well, we're citizens who actually deserve to live in a functioning society. At this point, our only options are consumers. So we can choose to buy this or buy that, but you know, we're not going to be able to buy our way out of this problem. This is massive social inequalities that are, you know, being created by these institutions that are just absolutely sociopathic and have an entirely global reach now. So, you know, the idea that we're actually going to be able to buy a certain product and let that have some kind of impact is just insane. And this is what the mainstream environmental movement, of course, has been pushing now for a good 20 or 30 years. And it really does reduce our capacity to think of ourselves as actors, you know, as actual agents for profound change. And, you know, you take a look at a movie like Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. And, you know, at the end of that movie, you know, he manages, first of all, to talk about the fact that the planet's being destroyed without ever once mentioning industrial civilization and without ever once mentioning capitalism, which is fairly astounding since that's the problem. And then at the end of the movie, he's got that list of things that we can all do. And every single one of them is simply, you know, a personal consumer choice. And even if every single person in the United States did every single one of those things, we'd only reduce carbon emissions by not even 25%. So it's useless. It's pointless. It's just not what's going to do the trick. And we don't need moral exhortation. The only solutions to political problems are political movements. And this is where the left has just gotten completely derailed in this country. And I don't understand it, because if we don't get that concept, then I don't know who's going to.
Okay, well, what if millions of people across the country, across the world, understood, you know, it's industrial civilization? What if there was some massive paradigm shift? Is that enough? Do you see that happening?
Well, if there was that kind of a massive paradigm shift, then the job of those people would be to stop industrial civilization. It wouldn't be to simply withdraw and perhaps buy slightly nicer products. They'd have to actually put their bodies between what is destroying this planet, mostly that's the fossil fuel economy, and what's left of this planet. So it would be great if we could have massive civil disobedience that would actually interrupt that destruction, that would actually try to stop, you know, what's happening, but I don't see that. I don't see the numbers in anywhere near the scale that we're going to need them. So that's why in our book, Deep Green Resistance, we try to put back on the table a lot of the strategies and tactics that the left has really abandoned for the last 70 years.
Okay, well, what about the notion of technology? A lot of people call it the techno fix. You know, we still talk a lot about solar panels and wind turbines, and that really is, you know, a big source of hope for a lot of people. What do you think?
Well, I'm sorry that, you know, to bring them down, but there's a lot of problems with that. The first is that every single one of those products, you know, like solar panels, windmills, they rest on an industrial platform. Okay, the only way you're going to produce them is in a factory that's powered by fossil fuel, because they're incredibly energy intensive, as are all industrial products. You can back it up one more step and say, and where do the base resources come from? Well, you're talking about things like metal. Do you know what it takes to mine metal? I mean, entire ecosystems are destroyed to get, you know, the steel and the iron and the copper and all the things that are required to build things like whatever, if it's computer chips, whether it's cars, whether it's solar panels, it doesn't matter. It means that the mountains have to be destroyed to get the bauxite out of them, and it means indigenous people have to be displaced. And that's what's required to make those groovy green solar panels. They're incredibly toxic. I mean, there's a 60-mile lake in China now that's just, it's just a toxic, you know, just toxic bubbles, essentially. And all the people around the area, they all have pancreatic cancer. It's every bit as horrifying as the tar sands or mountaintop removal. It's just that it's happening in China. So we can pretend that, you know, there's no environmental impact. But to create a solar panel or a windmill is every bit as destructive as all the other industrial processes. And especially they require what are called rare earth metals. And the problem with rare earth metals is that they don't occur in discrete veins of ore the way that other metals do. So they, you have to, you know, mine huge amounts of dirt, and then they have to be processed with really, really toxic chemicals. And then finally, at the end of the day, you might get a little bit of these rare earth metals that are then needed to make the magnets that actually make the wind turbines be anywhere near efficient. And that's what's required for these things. So you need to do like a way bigger kind of step-by-step, you know, A to B, where did these things come from and what is required to make them? You can't just say, oh, well, they fall out of the sky like rain and we can just put them on our rooftops, because it's still that industrial process. It takes vast amounts of energy and creates incredible amounts of toxins. So these are not going to be any kind of a solution to this.
Now, Leah, for reasons that we're not going to go into in depth, but people can definitely check out in your book, you explain in the Deep Green Resistance book, industrial civilization is not redeemable. Why is it so hard for people to accept that? How can they accept that? And is it really necessary for them to accept that?
Well, we'll take that one at a time. I think the reason that it's hard for people who are at the top of the pyramid, the rich in the rich countries, the industrialized nations, I think it's hard for people to accept it because we're dependent on that system. And like any good abuser, capitalism and industrial civilization, they've made us dependent on those systems for our basic necessities. Which is to say that if you recognize that your food and your water come from the land and come from rivers, you're going to defend that land and those rivers. But if you're dependent on the grocery store and the bank and your car, you're going to defend those things because your life depends on them. And that's what all good abusers do. They cut off all the other options and they make you dependent. I think in other countries, there is clearly resistance to industrial civilization. There are indigenous people all around the world fighting this because it's their land that's being destroyed for us to get the aluminum and the rare earth metals. So I think that there may be more hope for this in other countries. I think it's really hard in the rich nations, though, because we've been so well metabolized into that system that it is very hard for people to see a way around it, because this is all we know and this is what we're dependent on.
Thanks, Leah. Eric, we're going to move on to you now. You co-authored the book with Leah, and the book, again, is called Deep Green Resistance. What does a deep green resistance, what is that?
Well, the deep green would be in contrast to the bright green or shallow green of kind of mainstream environmentalism, which there's the things that Leah has just been talking about. It takes capitalism for granted. It takes industrial culture for granted. It takes, you know, that are basically a first world living standard for granted. And a deep green resistance analysis said, okay, well, we need to look a little bit deeper than that. We need to look at what's actually causing these environmental catastrophes that we're facing. What are the root issues? Not just to take these trappings of this status quo for granted, but to look at those systems and to look at the power structure that those in power are using to extract wealth and exploit the majority of the planet's human population. So that's where the resistance part comes in.
What kind of actions would this resistance movement be taking that would kind of distinguish it from the current approach?
we really want to see a full spectrum of action. So, you know, we see the need for more serious action and a more confrontational action. We're not saying that it's bad for people to be doing things like, you know, growing local food or building local communities. Quite the opposite. Those things are very important. They're necessary, but they're not sufficient based on the scale of damage and the time that we have available to make change. So one of the things that's different about us is that we don't want people just to be working on moral suasion. We don't think that any corporate bosses are going to be convinced to change their ways by compelling argument. What we need to do is to be able to generate political force, and that can be many different kinds of force. You know, that can be social force, like the force that people used in Ireland during the land war to get rid of absentee landlords. That was the original boycott. A landlord named Charles Scott, who people refused to talk to him, to deliver his mail, to work for him, all of that stuff, and he was driven out. There's economic pressure, like the kind of pressure that was used in the Montgomery bus boycott, where people withdrew the economic power and forced that system to collapse as well. So, you know, there are many different kinds of force. It doesn't just have to be physical force or violence. But we have to understand that we're engaged in a political conflict, an ongoing conflict. And we have to organize ourselves into the kind of resistance movement that can be confrontational. So that might mean things like nonviolent blockades and sit-ins. And it might mean things like, you know, shutting down infrastructure that other people are doing around the world in say, the Niger Delta. You know, the movement of the emancipation of the Niger Delta is shutting down oil pipelines and refineries by attacking them directly. So there's a whole spectrum of action that we can use and we have to kind of choose our tactics based on our own context, what's going to be effective where we are. The important thing is being able to mobilize that political force. So in terms of using nonviolent blockades, you know, you need a lot of people to mobilize for there. Each person uses relatively little, whereas in something like the attack infrastructure that people in MEN do or that indigenous people are doing in many different countries, well, then a smaller number of people are able to engage much more force in that way.
Say if you're starting from scratch, how do you build a resistance group?
The crucial distinction here that we should make between above ground and underground resistance movements. So above ground resistance movements or above ground resistance groups are those that really operate kind of publicly, openly, transparently. And their goal would be to mobilize as many people as possible, to communicate a message as widely as possible. A good example would be in occupied France during World War II, they had these movements that were organized around the underground newspapers, because this is how they would kind of unite people and communicate information. And in North America today, there are lots of above-ground movements. Underground movements are organized very differently. They're really organized around secrecy. Their purpose is to accomplish specific tasks, like illegal tasks or repressed tasks, usually, to mobilize as much, you know, force as we were just talking about, to mobilize that acute force. And so people who want to undertake resistance have to kind of make a decision about what kind of career they want to have, because you can't belong to an above-ground group and an underground group at the same time. That will compromise the security of each one.
Say you have your group, and your book goes into so much more detail than we could possibly cover in this show, but you have your group. How do you judge what you're actually going to target? Say we're talking about infrastructure, for example.
Sure. Well, there's pretty handy target selection criteria that we can use that have been, you know, written for asymmetric warfare. The United States government has written manuals about guerrilla warfare, and they suggest four target selection criteria that would apply, you know, whether you're talking about direct attacks on infrastructure or whether you're talking about a nonviolent set of blockades or lockdowns. And one of the criteria that they use is criticality. So how important is a target? How important is it in the network of that those in power are using? And that's one of the main reasons that I think that, you know, the environmental movements and really a lot of movements in general haven't always been as effective as they could, because they're not looking for very critical targets. They're not looking for very important targets in the network. Maybe, you know, smashing windows and that sort of thing is usually as far as resistance goes. And that makes sense by another selection criteria. It's accessibility, that those targets are easy to get to, but they're not really important enough to make a big difference. Movements that do this on a regular basis, like MEND in Nigeria, they tend to look for the most important parts of the network, refineries, pipeline nodes, that sort of thing. And then there are two other criteria as well, and those are recuperability. That is how easy it is, or how easy it is for those in power to kind of replace that, and vulnerability. So how easy it is to break or interdict or blockade that particular piece of infrastructure.
This is Terra Verde, a weekly environmental radio show on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, or KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. Today, authors Lier Keith and Eric McBay join me, Adam Greenfield, to discuss why an organized resistance to industrialism is necessary and how it might work. Okay, well, one of the things that we've seen with the Occupy movement is, a very widespread use of consensus decision making, but in other cases we've often seen that kind of lead to a very slow, laborious process where in the end things kind of collapse. What kind of decision making process do you think would be appropriate for a deep green resistance movement?
Well, we talk about a number of different decision making methods in the book, all the way from, you know, authority and rank structure through to consensus. One of the shortcomings of consensus, in addition to the fact that it takes a long time, as you mentioned, is that it really requires everyone to have kind of a similar starting point to begin with. So if you want to have a resistance movement, then the people who are engaged in that consensus decision-making process would actually have to all agree, you know, we need serious resistance, we need to be able to take risks and engage in self-sacrifice. And if that's not present, then what the consensus process tends to do is go to the lowest common denominator. It tends to go back to the status quo, so the decision ends up being something that, you know, is not very risky, is not confrontational, because that's what, you know, everyone can kind of agree on. I think that it's important for radicals and militants in the above ground, and underground, but in the above ground particularly, to organize amongst themselves and be able to make decisions to kind of lead the way or inspire that more serious action. In the underground, this is not a very applicable or appropriate model, because underground groups are really talking about life or death situations sometimes, where people need to be able to make snap decisions. You know, in underground groups might make broader decisions about kind of strategy in a consensus manner or using a more participatory approach, but when they actually carry out actions, someone has to be, you know, if only temporarily, in charge and able to make those snap judgments.
When you're talking about an underground group, you can't know each other. There has to be a firewall between the active cells. And that means that the 500 people who are engaged in whatever it is they're doing, they can't all sit in the same room and come to consensus, because they literally cannot know who the other people are for everybody's safety. So it really does require a completely different form of decision making. And I know that doesn't sit well with a lot of us, because we've, you know, been raised up in these movements that are strongly democratic, that believe in, you know, no hierarchy and everything has to be egalitarian. But to have the kind of serious underground that we're calling for, it's a very, very bad model. I mean, it just can't be done when you're talking about serious underground action.
Yeah, and actually one of the points to address that, Lier, in your book is that you say that the military uses the hierarchical model, and for everything that we might say about the military, they've certainly been very effective in what they do.
Correct. They basically rule the world.
And underground movements are really based on that principle of need to know. and consensus of participating or participatory decisions, you know, everyone has to know as much as possible to make a good decision. So that doesn't work with the kind of secrecy that's required for the underground.
How would such a group bring in new people and be able to insulate itself against, you know, infiltrators?
Well, they have to be fairly careful. There's a whole chapter in the Deep Green Resistance book about recruitment, and there's kind of a checklist of different screening methods that different movements use, underground groups specifically. And of course, there's no time to go over that whole thing. But they tend to use things like background checks, detailed interviews. Sometimes they'll, you know, follow people around to see if they are who they say they are. They will often use kind of a test task to ensure that someone is trustworthy and will do what they say. And then, of course, an underground group doesn't actually invite someone in and doesn't reveal themselves until that candidate has really proven themselves. So they're very cautious about that sort of thing.
Eric and Leah, I think you can both answer this question. A lot of people listening to this would, perhaps one of their first thoughts would be, what you're saying sounds essentially like suicide. I mean, to even try and attempt to dismantle industrialism is just absolutely impossible. What would you say to that?
Well, people said that about slavery, and, you know, we don't have that kind of economic slavery anymore in this country. People said that about women getting the right to vote, and we do vote now. So all along the line, there's always going to be people who say this is not possible. And I understand psychologically that it's not possible for people, but that doesn't mean that it's not physically possible. And I do like to point to Mend again as our example, because the estimates are that there are maybe 300 or 400 people in the group Mend, and they have brought down 30% of the oil economy of Nigeria permanently. 30%. There are oil companies that have left because they see that there's no profit in it anymore because Mend has been so successful. And in one series of attacks last year, for instance, they brought 80% of the oil economy to a halt in one series of attacks. 80% of the oil economy. We've got to understand how incredible that is. And this is just a few hundred people who are well-trained and well-organized. You know, they clearly studied other militant movements, and they understand how to plan things strategically and, you know, how to go after those points that will bring on the cascading systems failure. But that's the number of people. That's all it takes is, you know, 300 or 400 people to have that kind of impact on the oil economy there. There's no reason it couldn't be done here. And you could extend that to, you know, coal and to natural gas and fracking and certainly the tar sands. But all of this is incredibly vulnerable infrastructure. And the thing to know about this kind of asymmetric warfare is that, you know, the principles have been honed for decades. People who are dead serious have figured out that this works and how it works. And you can learn about it at places like West Point and the U.S. Army and in training camps all over the world because it works. I mean, that's why people are using it. Now, we may not agree with the people who are using it. We may not like their movements, but some of the movements we do agree with. And that's not the point. The point is that, you know, as a strategy, this is an incredibly successful way to engage when you don't have a lot of power and what you're up against is something really big.
And one of the things we talk about in the book is the issue of risk. What do you risk by acting and what do you risk by not acting? In our current situation, you risk by not acting is the entire planet. There was a report that came out from the International Energy Agency last month, which is a very conservative organization, that said we had 5 years left to stop runaway global warming. I mean, they're talking about 5 years, and after that point, the tipping points of a melting polar ice cap and the drought in the Amazon and that sort of thing would become self-sustaining so that nothing we could do after that would reverse it. And this is, you know, a very conservative organization. There are lots of scientists who've been ringing the alarm bells for a long time. What we risk by acting, sure, we risk our personal safety, and it's frightening. And that's one of the reasons that people don't fight back. But in the scope of things, I think it's more dangerous and more suicidal not to resist. Of course, people have been having these debates in resistance movements throughout history. People were having these debates in occupied Europe, in concentration camps and in ghettos. Some people always said, you know, it's too dangerous. It's too late to fight back. But some people did. And in Sobibor and in Warsaw and in many other places, the people who fought back had a higher survival rate than the people who didn't. And of course, in the broader picture, I understand that some people, many people, probably most people, are too scared to personally put themselves on the front lines. So we should remember that, you know, only 2 or 3% of any resistance movement is actually on the front lines, actually picks up arms or goes to the deli counter sit-in. It's the job of the rest of that movement to offer them the moral and material support they need to survive, whether that's, you know, sending them donations or putting them up in their house or writing them letters in prison.
Leah and Eric, we're almost out of time. What role do you think your book, Deep Green Resistance, has in creating the kind of movement we've been talking about today? I mean, can someone really just read your book and then go and do it?
I think that, you know, that's our hope, that we want to really to introduce a fundamental shift in the way that the movement works, in the way that we think about these things. If I were starting an underground group, I'd want to do a lot more background research than just our book, and I want to be very cautious, because one of the rules that, you know, the movements in Occupied Europe had about planning actions was that you should always have an escape route plan before you take it. At the same time, we have so little time left that we have to balance, you know, that need for caution with the urgency of the need for action. And there's already been people who've been inspired to start an above ground movement called the Deep Green Resistance Movement. And Lier and I are on the steering board for that. They're at deepgreenresistance.org. So there's some very exciting, motion happening that makes me optimistic.
If you feel like you have a warrior spirit, it's really the time to come forward, because we've got to put ourselves between what is left of this planet and fossil fuel if there's going to be any life at all left in 100 years. And that's not a hyperbole. It really is coming to an end. Every single biotic system is in a state of collapse. And with global warming coming down the pike, God knows what it's going to look like. So I really want people to feel that emergency. I want them to be cautious, but we've got to put all this on the table and at least try to think of solutions that match the scale of the problem. And that is not buying a different kind of light bulb.
So, Eric, how can we, how can people listening find out more about the Deep Green Resistance movement?
Well, the best way is to go to our website, deepgreenresistance.org. And at that site, you can also find other readings and listen to the talks that Lier and I gave at Earth at Risk, the big event in Berkeley last month. You can also listen to the talks by Derek Jensen, Stephanie McMillan, Wazi Atawin, Tom Slinzy, and Arundhati Roy at the same event.
That's about all the time we have today. Thank you very much, Lier Keith and Eric McBay, for joining us on Terra Verde.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Leah and Eric for joining me today. We hope you'll tune into Terra Verde next week. This show and others are available at kpfa.org. I'm Adam Greenfield, and have a great weekend.
Hey.
You are listening to Terra Verde on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno. Join us again over lunch between 1 and 2 in the afternoon on Fridays to hear more about the unfolding future of the planet.
Obrigado.
Asante.
Thank you for listening and supporting KPFA 94.1 FM.
Thank y'all so much.
And good afternoon. You are tuned to 94.1 FM KPFA here in Berkeley and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.